You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. I'd like to welcome David Parsons. He's a carnivore conservation biologist with the Rewilding Institute in Albuquerque, rewilding.org. And he's science advisor to Project Coyote. He worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for 25 years. And we're here today to talk about predators, wolves, coyotes, and these creatures out on the landscape. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So you have been studying all kinds of wildlife. I mean, you're a conservation biologist. You've studied birds, and then you got involved with the wolf reintroduction program here in New Mexico. Was that your first kind of introduction to the deep study of wolves and their role in ecosystems?
Yes, it was, actually. I'd been in very different program areas with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. That was my introduction to the wolf and wolf ecology and what needs to be done to, in our case, bring them back from almost near extinction.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, wolves are such a kind of charismatic species, and I've talked to so many people who say, oh, well, when you're doing conservation, especially fundraising, you need a kind of beautiful species. But of course, they're one species in an ecosystem, which is an interconnected web of so many other kinds of life, plant life, animal life, and so on. Talk about wolves and what their role historically was here in the Southwest.
Yes. Well, the wolves we had in New Mexico were the subspecies of gray wolf called the Mexican gray wolf. And all gray wolves came to this continent across the Bering Land Strait.
So they came from Russia?
Yes, they did, from Siberia. The Mexican wolves are believed to be remnants of the very first wave of gray wolves that came. And at that point in time, they were able to find their way through glacial fields along the coastline primarily and distribute themselves to the south. And so Mexican gray wolves have been known to exist as far south as almost Mexico City. Then as, you know, glaciers receded and reformed, gray wolves moved about the continent wherever suitable habitats were at the time. But the Mexican gray wolves were far enough south to not have been impacted by subsequent glaciation. So they had the longest time to evolve. And they evolved in an ecosystem that's a bit different than those in the north. Prey species in the southern part of the range are smaller. The deer are smaller. Elk phased out. Didn't even exist in Mexico, for example. And temperatures are warmer. So our Mexican gray wolves are smaller than their northern cousins by a significant amount. So a large Mexican gray wolf would be about 80 pounds, but a large northern gray wolf could be 120, 130 pounds. But that's adaptation to the environment. So they're the most ancient remnant of the most ancient wave of gray wolves that came. They had a pretty wide distribution in essentially Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, maybe into southern Utah and Colorado, and well down into Mexico through the Sierra Madre Range. And their role was, as far as we know, they had the same apex predator role in the ecosystem, but the prey base was comprised of smaller animals. The deer, for example, this southern subspecies of the white-tailed deer rarely gets over 100 pounds. Peccary would have probably been another prey base, or javelina, and everywhere, north and south, they preyed on beaver when they could. We've learned now, especially with the grand experiment that we have in Yellowstone National Park, where wolves were gone for 70 years and brought back, we've learned a lot about how they structure ecosystems and stabilize ecosystems and promote biological diversity and all those sorts of things that top predators are now known to do in ecosystems.
Well, this is something that, whether we're talking about a marine ecosystem that has sharks in it, or whether we're talking about a mountainous ecosystem like we have here in the Rockies, where we've got wolves and other predators, or really anywhere, ecosystems always seem to have some kind of apex predator, as you mentioned. What does that mean? And talk a little bit more about what their job is in keeping the rest of the system balanced.
Well, essentially, their job is played out in two ways. One is that they essentially eat the plant eaters and keep the plant eaters at a level where they're not overgrazing or overbrowsing their food source.
So it, on the Great Plains, it might have been bison.
Exactly.
Or it might be deer or antelope or whatever.
Yes. They also regulate the populations of smaller predators, coyotes and skunks and opossums and raccoons.
How do they do that?
In the case of coyotes, the two species are antagonistic. They view each other as competing. So a wolf would never let a coyote come into its territory, or if it did, it would try to kill it. They do the same thing with their own species, actually, once they've established a territory. That's how they regulate their own abundance on the landscape, is through territoriality. But by regulating these smaller carnivores, then that allows another guild of critters below them, the rodent community, to remain robust and diverse. So, you know, it goes all the way down. I mean, you can even go to the soil and the water if you want, and what their effects might be.
Talk about that a little bit, the soil and the water. Because again, I mean, people who are listening, they think about wolves and wolves eating deer. What does that have to do with rivers?
Right. Well, the prime example is in Yellowstone National Park, where wolves were purposefully removed around 1920. You know, it was the era when predators were considered bad species and we'd be better off without them. We would have more elk and more deer. And we did. You know, the elk population in particular boomed. And elk love new growth of willows and cottonwoods and aspens along stream banks. And, you know, they got to the point where they were eating everything new that grew. And, you know, the remaining plants got old and decadent and eventually fell over. And so you could look at the stream and there was no row of streamside vegetation of willows or cottonwoods, and even the aspen forests further up the slope were old and decadent, no new aspens growing.
Because the elk were eating them all, because they, in turn, were not getting eaten by wolves.
Exactly.
Or even if they weren't getting eaten, and I think this is a really interesting piece of it too, they were scared of getting eaten, so they would stay away from the rivers.
Right. There's another field that has emerged called the ecology of fear.
Yeah.
Of how animals' behavior is regulated by just having to be vigilant, you know, under the threat of predation. Once the wolves were brought back, things started to change. Not instant, but willows were repopulating the string banks and aspens were regenerating, alders were regenerating. Beavers had left the stream for lack of anything to eat. Now beavers are moving back. They're rebuilding their dams. We see the growth of the willows and cottonwoods and aspens and alders, and where, you know, that creates more habitat for songbirds.
And also cools the water.
It cools the water.
So that certain fish,
yes,
that are native to that area can thrive.
Yes, exactly.
So that's Yellowstone, and it's a case that is brought up quite a lot when people want to talk about reintroduction of predators into an ecosystem. You can see the kind of before after, you can see the degradation and then the healing, although not that many wolves are in that area now compared to what it historically was. Is that correct?
No, I think in terms of just Yellowstone National Park, the wolves have seemed to have stabilized.
Okay.
And that probably represents their density historically, because the rest of that ecosystem is pretty much intact in terms of all the species being there. Black bear, grizzly bear, cougars, wolves, it's pretty complete now with the wolf back. It's stabilized around 100 wolves for all of Yellowstone National Park. But outside of Yellowstone National Park, if we start looking at wolf recovery in the Northwest in general, we don't allow wolves to achieve their natural distribution and abundance on the landscape, because we humans think that's too many wolves.
Because of cattle ranching?
Because of cattle ranching and hunting and a number of other things. So we regulate them below what's called their ecologically effective density. And so you might not see those same changes to the ecosystem outside of a protected area.
So when you look at, for example, here in the Southwest, what are the ecological effects of having wolves been basically almost entirely removed from the ecosystem of the southern Rocky Mountains and the Southwest?
Well, it's a good question, and it's kind of a nuanced answer, because the wolves were removed at the same time that livestock were brought in unprecedented numbers. At the same time wolves were removed, there was unregulated hunting and market hunting on just about everything. Bison and elk and deer and pronghorn and all those animals came really quite close to extinction themselves before programs were put in place, before game departments were established and some protections were given to them and hunting was regulated. So it's hard to parse out just what caused what, but the degradation of ecosystems was horrendous because of all that, and especially the unregulated cattle grazing and a lack of recognition back then in the late 1800s and early 1900s of how fragile our ecosystems were. When they first came out with cattle, they saw, you know, you can see these old stories of, you know, grass up to the belly of the horse, and wow, you know, that looked like wonderful cattle pasture. And so they brought them out, and sheep, but they didn't understand that the fertility of the soil was all contained in about the top 4 to 6 inches of the crust. And once they broke through that, the fertility was gone, the land protection was gone. These big gullies you see when you drive through the New Mexican rangeland landscape, these deep cut streams that are down 10, 15, 20 feet below the surface, they were on the surface originally, but you bare the soil, nothing stops the water, and so these erosive forces set in and you get really drastic changes. And streams and water sources, springs dry up, wetlands disappear. All sorts of things happen.
And then you have a situation that people who hadn't seen the earlier version of the sort of natural version of New Mexico think is normal.
Exactly. If you drive from here to Las Cruces, normal would have been all that would have been grassland. Now it's all shrubland, creosote bush.
Let's talk about wolves as a species. Tell us a little bit about what their lives are like. How do they live? What do they eat? What are their family groups?
They form pack structures. It varies. I mean, packs in Yellowstone, when they first put them back because prey was so abundant, with grew to upwards of 20 animals, but normal is more like 6 to 12. They have a social structure within the pack. And, you know, the way they guarantee that they don't overpopulate their space is done in two primary ways. The pack establishes a territory that they defend against any interlopers.
Might be, as you said, coyotes or other wolves.
Yep, coyotes or other wolves, primarily. Force them to live elsewhere. And there's a great story in Yellowstone about how the coyotes reacted once the wolves came in.
Oh, what happened?
They had it all, of course, you know, for 70 years, and all of a sudden they've got somebody chasing their tail. They essentially moved out of the wolf-occupied territory, and their population plummeted by 50% initially. But then they had to relearn how to live in the vicinity of wolves by occupying primarily the spaces between packs, and then be more stealthy about slipping in to forage on a wolf kill. So their behavior changed, and their numbers have come back up a bit from that initial shock of all of a sudden there's a bigger dog on the landscape. So that's one mechanism. And the other is that within their own pack structure, they regulate their own breeding. And it's just the dominant pair, often called the alpha pair, that primarily are the breeders. And a pack may have animals in it that are of breeding age, and often does, yearlings and two-year-olds. They are suppressed from breeding just through behavioral means by being subordinate animals. So they regulate their own reproduction and they regulate their space on the land. And so that's how, you know, we would call a normal situation of how they would be distributed on the landscape and how abundant they would be and how they don't overexploit their food base.
You've talked a little bit about the long history of wolf policy and wolf killing over the last, well, more than a century, but how did that come into being? I mean, was it all about cattle? I mean, what happened here in the Southwest where wolves were concerned?
In the West and Southwest, it was pretty much all about cattle and sheep. that were brought out in big numbers. And then it had to do with the politics of that, in that those, you know, early cattle barons were quite politically connected. And they soon learned that they couldn't get the job done themselves. So they put pressure on the federal government to create programs to eradicate the predators in the West. And thus was created what is now Wildlife Services, which was first created as the Predatory Animal and Rodent Control Service.
Wildlife Services seems like such a ironic name.
It's a bit oxymoronic, yes. Yeah. The service is to kill them, primarily. Although there's, you know, there are efforts underway to try to get the agency to, you know, move toward non-lethal means, but there's a pretty deeply ingrained culture that still is the culture of killing as the solution to wildlife conflict.
So then the Endangered Species Act came along in the 1970s, really just in time to save the Mexican gray wolf.
Totally at the nick of time. The program to eradicate Mexican gray wolves in the United States was successful by around 1940, but wolves kept dispersing out of Mexico, so the program continued to just pick off those wolves that came into the states until about the 1950s, when somebody got a good idea of, well, why don't we solve the problem in Mexico? So they offered their services to Mexico to show them how to eradicate wolves, and so the program got focused there until you know, they were nearly gone when the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973. The Mexican gray wolves were not put on the list of endangered species until 1976. At that time, there were no known wolves in the United States, no Mexican gray wolves. And there were very few left in Mexico. So the Fish and Wildlife Service hired a famous trapper named Roy McBride out of Texas, who was good at trapping wolves. So they hired him to go to Mexico. He trapped from 1977 to 1980, and he was able to catch only 6 wolves. 1 died in a trap. 5 were brought back under an agreement with Mexico and the United States that they could come to breeding facilities in the United States, which they did. 4 of those were males, and only 1 was female. She was pregnant when she was caught. She gave birth to, I believe it was 5 pups, and 1 was female and 4 were males. 1 pup died, and it was the female.
Oh my goodness.
It took another couple years to get her mated again, and she was more successful then. And so the breeding program finally got started. It almost didn't.
Now, when there's a breeding area, I mean, a breeding in captivity situation, what does it look like? I mean, are they on what feels like open land to them? How much land are they on? I mean, they're presumably not in a dog kennel.
It looks more like a zoo.
Okay.
Like a large pen in a zoo. And so there's, you know, early on, it didn't really matter how much space they got, you know, whether they were able to actually live like wolves, which they can't in any kind of confinement.
So they were being given food.
Yeah. So the goal was to get them to breed successfully.
So when you do that over a number of wolf generations and they're in captivity, do they retain, like, let's say the 7th or 8th generation, the ability and the instinct to hunt?
They seem to. One of the first packs we put out in 1998, no wolf had been in the wild. Those wolves and several generations of them had known nothing but captivity. They do go into larger, more secluded enclosures once they're identified as potential release animals. So they're not seeing people, but there's not a situation where they can hunt, but we can feed them what they would be hunting, like roadkill deer and elk. So they're tasting the right thing and they're seeing the carcass.
And they have to stay away from people so that they don't develop friendly relationships.
Exactly. So they maintain their fear of people.
Yeah.
And one of the groups that was first put out was a pack of 4. And it was less than 2 weeks and they took down a cow elk. So people ask me that question and I say, does your dog chase rabbits? And the dog's been removed from that genetic instinct for 10,000 years or more.
Right.
So there are instincts that you can't breed out of them.
Yeah, I was thinking about that after I asked you the question. I'm like, well, my old Jack Russell Terrier, were he 6 times his size, would have survived just fine in the wild.
Yeah. So it's the nuances. You know, a lot of hunting is learned by wolf pups from their parents on how to hunt and what to hunt, but the instinct to chase and kill seems to be there.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to be back in just a second. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. So wolves were driven almost to extinction, then, I mean, it's such a weird story. The same person who was trapping them to kill them is now trapping them to save them. Mm-hmm. But it's a really small gene pool. And so you've got the problems that come along with a small gene pool. Or do you?
We do. We certainly do. So not all those wolves that McBride brought out of Mexico were able to actually be introduced into the gene pool because of the lack of breeding females. So there were only 3 Mexican wolves that were considered founders of the captive population.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Were there any left in Mexico, by the way?
That was the last. 1980 was the last time any wolf was documented in Mexico.
So basically, we took their last wolves after teaching them how to kill their own wolves.
Right. So
wow.
They're now the recipient back of wolves out of the captive population, and they have their own captive breeding centers now in Mexico. So,
but all from these 3 animals.
Yes, that's a little more of that story. So that was a big concern. And there were other wolves in captivity that were being called wolves, Mexican wolves. One line was here in the United States, and it was called the Ghost Ranch lineage of Mexican gray wolves. The last wolf live captured in the United States was in 1959 in extreme southern Arizona, just north of the Mexican border. Roy McBride saw it and he thought it was wolf-dog hybrid. 2 years later, in 1961, there was a Canadian tourist who had been in southern Sonora, Mexico, and some locals there offered to sell him a wolf pup that they had dug from a den. So he bought one. It was a female. He was traveling on a motorcycle. And so he put it in the saddlebag of his motorcycle and he started driving home. He got across the border and had second thoughts, and he stopped at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum and offered them the wolf pup, which they gladly took. And when it became mature, they were able to mate it with that wolf that was captured that McBride
thought was a hybrid.
Pronounced was a hybrid. That's the genesis of the Ghost Ranch line of wolves, two founders. So we knew those were there, but we didn't know they were pure. There was another line like that in a zoo in Mexico City. They were bred in various zoos. They were traded, and some were, I think some might have even been sold. So around mid-90s, we finally had molecular genetic techniques that were sufficient to prove purity.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about.
So, you know, that was a new technology.
Right.
Before, it was all morphology.
It was all, well, that looks like
it. Right. Or it measures, you know, you measure the skulls and take all these measures and you look at what it looks like. You know, that was McBride's method, was just visual morphology. But we were able to look at the genes. And so I assembled a team of the leading canid a geneticist in the country at the time. And so they got blood samples from all 3 lines. At the same time, they got blood samples from coyotes in the same region throughout the West and dogs. So they could also answer the question of whether or not they had admixed with dogs or coyotes, which they're fully capable of doing. And they finished their work and they discovered that both those other lines were pure Mexican wolves with no indication of hybridization with anything else.
Which means that you had more wolves to add to the gene pool?
Exactly. That gave us 4 more founders.
Okay, so now you have 7 founders.
Now we have 7 founders, and that's the best
and that's it.
We could do. So that's now what we're working with. And those started getting mixed in the late 90s. in the captive breeding facilities.
So what did the wolf recovery plan look like? I mean, first you breed enough so that you have some number. You can tell us how many you need in order to start letting them go. And then you start letting them go. But it's not just like, okay, let's drive them to the woods and we're done.
Right. Well, we set that number at about 100 wolves in captivity as to when it might be safe to start pulling some off, as long as what genes they had were still represented somewhere in the captive population. So
right.
We didn't want to risk losing genes. So that was our goal. But at that time, we only had the McBride line wolves to work with. So beyond that, you know, you need to secure approval for a really big place with excellent prey base. We did the studies on that, but one could look at a map of the Southwest, Arizona and New Mexico, and look at the biggest green blob on the map, which is the Gila National Forest and the Apache Sitgraves National Forest that it connects to over in Arizona, which is about 7,000 square miles of prime wolf habitat. So the situation I have with wolves, most species go extinct or near extinct for loss of habitat, but with the wolf, it was persecution. The habitat and the prey base was there. It was just getting the permission and working through the politics of getting to put them back.
And the politics are no joke.
No, they were a joke, actually. They were the single most impediment to getting it done was the politics.
What was that like?
Well, you know, it wasn't the good old days, you know, where you could just, you know, throw them in the back of a truck and go put them out. We have, you know, all kinds of rules and regulations in the National Environmental Policy Act, and we had to do assessments, and we had to write an environmental impact statement. We had to do the evaluations of where the best habitat was and compare various alternatives for where to put them. And
this is all science. I mean, this is not the political part of it. This
right.
is like assessing habitat, doing these environmental impact studies based on data.
Right. So the input to the political process is science in, hopefully best decisions out, but those decisions get muddied by the politics as you go along. But we did write our documents based on best science. We got a lot of pushback on being allowed to put the wolves in the right place.
Who was pushing back and why?
Well, state game and fish agencies were pushing hard back on the Fish and Wildlife Service. Initially, they were not advocating or promoting or accepting the idea of wolf recovery at all in the states. That changed a little. It actually changed more in Arizona than it did in New Mexico and Texas. But eventually, the states agreed that they could support wolves. They could all get behind supporting wolves in one place, which turned out not to be the best place. And that place was the White Sands Missile Range.
What?
So that became... That became the push. We were getting a lot of direction to try to make White Sands Missile Range look suitable to accommodate Mexican wolf recovery.
That doesn't sound like a green blob on the map.
It's not the green blob on the map. It's not green, even.
Yeah.
It's a military base. Now, it's not the dunes. It's actual desert basin scrub habitat with a big mountain range running through the middle. And up higher in the mountain range was some habitat, some deer, no elk, very thin prey base. Yeah, it might have supported a pack or two or three of wolves, but that's not recovery.
So what happened?
Well, what happened was we, the team of biologists that were writing the impact statement, stuck with the science. You know, we showed the analysis on White Sands Missile Range alongside, you know, the other areas throughout the Southwest that were potentially suitable habitat, and showed, you know, where the best place was, and that's what we recommended. But I was personally getting pushback from my regional director at the time, who would take me aside on occasion and say, I see where you're going with this, but I just want you to know that, you know, we're going to start this at White Sands Missile Range. Those were conversations that I would just try to get out of as fast as I could. It's an interesting story that unfolded. That regional director left before we had made a final decision. But he got pulled up to be the second in command of the Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington, D.C. And his replacement was a lady who did not question, you know, our science. Wolf recovery everywhere it took place, which was only three places in the United States was red wolves in the Southwest and the northern Rocky Mountains, and ours was so controversial at the time that the Department of Interior did not delegate any decision authority down on that, which meant the Secretary of Interior held on to the authority to make the decision, and that was Bruce Babbitt under the Clinton administration. He'd already approved, you know, the projects in Yellowstone National Park, so we thought we had a friend in Bruce Babbitt and that everything would be okay. So John Rogers, the person putting pressure on me to do it in White Sands, was now sitting in the Washington office, and the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, a young woman came in named Molly Beatty that everybody was really excited about, a Clinton appointee. Thought she would be a really good director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, but she became ill with a brain tumor and died not long after she took that office.
Good heavens.
So now John Rogers, we'll call him Mr. White Sands, is the sitting acting director of the Fish and Wildlife Service. And the way this works is once you've got all the paperwork in place, you've got your final environmental impact statement, you've done all your public meetings and hearings, and you've gone through the entire process that took us 7 years to do that, then a small entourage from the region goes to Washington, D.C. for a, what usually is thought of as a pro forma ascension of briefings. You first go to the chief of endangered species. That was Jamie Clark at the time, who now runs Defenders of Wildlife and who was formerly the head of my division in Albuquerque.
So she was with Fish and Wildlife.
She was fish. These are all Fish and Wildlife positions.
Yeah.
So we brief her. She's on board. And then, you know, the group grows. You go to the deputy director for the program area that includes endangered species and brief them, and they're on board, and you move on to.
So it's like a march through town that more people are joining.
Right, through Washington, D.C.
Right.
So we were scheduled to go to the director and then to the secretary. We walk in to brief the director. I'm feeling pretty good about this process because all these people who report to the director are on board. So I thought, okay, everything's blown over. We're cool. And, of course, the director was John Rogers.
Mr. White Sands.
Mr. White Sands. I opened my mouth to give my prepared briefing, and he cut me off after the first couple of words and started chewing my ass for, why aren't we taking these wolves to White Sands Missile Range? Blah, blah, blah. Chew, 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 you know. And then he goes on, he says, well, we had science that showed that White Sands Missile Range, you know, would support like 60 wolves. And I said, finally, I got a chance to say something. John, I said, we didn't have that science. You know, we're following the best science here. He was not giving up on hammering me for not following those unofficial orders. Reason being, he had made commitments to the state game and fish directors. So,
and these are things that, you know, we sort of civilians out in radio land have no idea about, is that there's a federal bureaucracy and then there's a whole set of state bureaucracies, and they often, even though they're tasked with basically the same kind of jobs, are at odds with each other. And this is an example of that.
Yes, is a prime example of that. So time ran out with the director, and it was time to brief the secretary. You don't keep a cabinet-level secretary waiting for his briefing. So John Rogers had not stopped chewing me out. He had not endorsed me to go present our recommendation to the secretary.
But so what did you do?
He had not given me any other instructions either. So you can imagine, as a project-level biologist, I was a wreck, especially after I was just getting chewed out. So we walked into the secretary's briefing room, and it's beautiful, you know, hardwood-walled, paneled room with a long hardwood table, and maybe 15 or 20 various people in positions within the Department of Interior sitting around the table. So the secretary wasn't in yet, but his handler came to greet me and explained to me how it would work. And she said, so the secretary's going to sit right here at the end of this long table, and you're going to stand here right beside him, and here's your easel for your maps and charts that you want to show with your briefing. And
pre-PowerPoint.
Pre-PowerPoint, yes. She said, now, don't you worry about all these people around the table. She said, you just look at the secretary, and you direct your briefing to the secretary. Secretary walks in. Of course, Babbitt's from, you know, ranching families in the country where we were proposing to release wolves and southeastern Arizona. So he knew the country. And so, you know, he engages in a little small talk, and he's talking about Leopold. And we talked about, you know, the green fire incident with Leopold. And he says, I know where that happened, down on the Blue River or whatever. And yes, sir. And it comes time to do the briefing, and the last thing he said was, he turned and looked at me, and he said, "So I hear we're going to the Blue Range with these wolves," which is what we called that big area, the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area. And that's what they call the area where he, you know, his ranching family was from. And I broke my instructions. I did do a little check around the table. I glanced in the direction of John Rogers. And he was not making eye contact. And so I turned back to the secretary and I said, "Yes, sir," and finished the briefing. And he put the stamp on putting the rolls in the right place.
And so thus began the actual process of putting wolves back into the wild.
Almost. There was one more year of writing a federal regulation. So that took another year, and the secretary had to stamp that too. But so one more year, and then we had the green light to go.
And since then, there has been a wolf recovery program, which has not been without controversy, sabotage, and all kinds of problems. So what happened? What have these last, I guess, 20 years looked like in terms of actually having the goals of wolves doing their job in the wild?
It's been rough politically. Still a lot of pushback from the states on getting enough wolves out. A lot of poaching. I think now over 40 Mexican wolves illegally killed.
By ranchers? Do we know?
You know, nobody knows. They've only caught a few people, and there are some nuances to federal prosecutorial regulations that don't allow prosecutions of wolf killers unless you can prove that they're lying when they say they thought it was a coyote. And everybody's learned to say that. I thought it was a coyote. And so
that's a really big loophole.
Yeah, it's a huge loophole. It doesn't have to be there. It's Department of Justice policy. It's not a law.
Right.
It would never fly in a state. You couldn't kill a deer in a state, you know, out of season, or a doe when you didn't have a tag for a doe, and just say, "Well, I thought it was something else." I mean, you're going to lose your license and get a big fine, and have your gun and your truck taken away. But not so with the Endangered Species Act right now because of this silly policy. So a lot of poaching. No, I don't know who was doing it. I don't personally think that it's ranchers necessarily, because, you know, they have an image to protect anyway, because they're under assault from a lot of directions, especially on public lands. So,
right.
You know, at first, most of those illegal kills coincided with hunting seasons. So you've got a lot of people in the woods with guns, and you've got coyotes, the wolves that look a lot like big coyotes. But it's a problem, and still is. Last year, we had the highest number ever. We have the genetic issues that aren't being aggressively addressed, and they need to be, because we have animals in captivity now of these mixed lineages that could boost the genetics, and we need to boost the genetics because of the 130 wolves in the wild right now. Their average relatedness is like brothers and sisters.
So it's really a little too close.
It's way too close.
And so are there plans to introduce some of these slightly more distant relatives?
There are. We believe they're inadequate, that they're not aggressive enough. The states started pushing back against releasing adult families of wolves because their main concern was the wolf raised in captivity is maybe going to be habituated in some way to humans and cause more conflict than a wolf raised in the wild. So there's a new technique called cross-fostering of pups, where you find a match in captivity of a breeding pair that would be a good gene diversity boost for a breeding pair in the wild. You hope that they reproduce at the same time. Field team finds the den in the wild as soon as they can after pups are born. Two pups are taken out of the captive population, brought to the wild, and these facilities can be as far away as New York, for example. But they fly these pups out, go find the den, crawl in. If there's too many pups in the wild litter, they'll thin it by two to take them back to the captive family.
That can't be easy.
It's not easy. They'll take all the pups out, mix them, put them in a sack with the ones from the wild and some den dirt, and do a shake and bake and get them all smelling the same and tuck them back in, and it works.
Oh, my goodness.
It's always worked. I don't think there's ever been a pup rejected. Then the hope is that those pups will survive to breeding age,
right,
minimum of 2 years, and find a mate and breed, and then inject their genes into the population. So it's a long-term bet. And right now, the number of that have actually matured and bred is too small to be a major pulse of genetic input. So that's a problem that we conservation advocates, wolf advocates, are working on, trying to get more wolves released and trying to get them to go back to releasing adult pairs. And that's not the end of the problems that need to be addressed. They rewrote a recovery plan that's not likely to actually lead to recovery. And so that's under litigation. And
well, litigation is part of it. I mean, I was reading one of the articles you wrote, and you wrote basically every advance in the recovery of Mexican wolves was forced by lawsuits filed by conservation groups. And there are people who, in the agricultural community or in the general public who say, God, all these people with their lawsuits, and why can't we do this by cooperating and talking to each other instead of doing lawsuits? But lawsuits have been an incredibly effective tool.
Yeah, they actually got it started. And like I said, have been the cause of very significant advancement. But the story is interesting to get it started because the Fish and Wildlife Service in the late 1980s, they were getting pressure put on them by the conservation community to actually get going, to implement a recovery plan that was finished in 1982, start putting the wolves back. And so they queried the states, and they got big pushback from the states. They couldn't get a state to agree on endorsing any recovery site. They had a verbal, essentially illegal policy that they would not release wolves without the consent of a state or the land managing agency that the property was on, whether it's Forest Service or BLM or the Army in the case of the missile range. So they just came to a standstill with that. And so I think it was in 1990, the regional director at the time called a press conference, and he said the Mexican Wolf Recovery Program is being terminated for lack of a suitable recovery site. Well, we all know that the suitable recovery site was out there. It was the lack of political support for a suitable recovery site. And a group called the Wolf Action Group, formed of local and big national conservation groups, filed a lawsuit saying that the Fish and Wildlife Service had illegally delegated their mandated authority under the Endangered Species Act. They couldn't do that. It was their job to, do recovery, and also forced them to create a position and hire a biologist whose sole job was to run the program, which was the job I got. So that was the push to actually get it going, and then they didn't revise once they got started. They didn't revise the antiquated recovery plan that was written in 1982. There was pressure put on for that. It wasn't until 2017 that they finally revised the recovery plan, and it's totally politicized. A former recovery team of independent scientists recommended something entirely different. The states didn't like it, so the Fish and Wildlife Service put that plan on the shelf and invited the states into a process that was closed door to come to some consensus on what recovery should look like.
Which was, at that point, no longer really science-based.
Yeah, they made it look science-based, and it was based on a model that was based on science. But the only way the model could work to get to recovery was they established a limit based on what the states refer to as social tolerance. There's no science really behind it. And they had decided a couple of years earlier in a new regulation that magic number was 325 wolves in all of Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and wherever else they might go. They decided that was the limit and that they couldn't go north of Interstate 40. But none of that was based on real science. And so the independent science team said it's got to be 750 wolves, then it's got to be in three different populations, and two of those need to be north of I-40. But they put a stop in the model on the U.S. population at essentially 325, and they were coordinating with the folks in Mexico. And so they came up with enough science that's pretty sketchy that the remaining 200 wolves that their model claimed they needed to get to recovery would be done in Mexico. Comes a lot of problems with that. The regulations are not nearly as good in Mexico. The habitat's not as good. We have no authority over whether Mexico ever does that. And so we may never get to recovery unless we can change that recovery plan.
So this is where we're at today.
Yeah, that's where we're today, with one exception of this rule I spoke of in 2015 that set a cap on the numbers. That was litigated, and the conservation community won. And the judge, in a rare ruling, you hardly ever see it, said the agency's science was not sufficient. It was not the best science. And so the lady judge, Judge Zips, and her ruling was pretty strong on many parts of that regulation, that they didn't have science behind putting a cap on the population. They didn't have science to show that they were actually going to achieve recovery, especially with regard to gene diversity. And they didn't have science to justify putting a wall at I-40 and not letting wolves go to suitable habitats beyond, and a few other things. Now we're in the middle of that. They're just starting that process of changing the rule for the United States, and the judge has given them till May of 2021 to get it done. So there will be a scoping process opening really soon where public will have a chance for input that will guide the development of their environmental impact statement and eventually guide their recommendation, which has to comport in some way with the judge's ruling of the things that need to be fixed. So it's really our last best shot at getting it right for Mexican gray wolves.
Now, this is all you've been talking about, what's happening on the federal level. What about on the state level? We've had a change of government here in New Mexico fairly recently. Does that affect how the Mexican gray wolf program goes forward?
Well, I think it will, because the former administration had withdrawn completely from cooperating in the program. And in fact, they'd gone beyond that. They actually became obstructionists through the Game Commission. And the new administration under Governor Luan Grisham has formed a new Game Commission. And that Game Commission, within the last month or two, voted to rejoin the program to cooperate with the Fish and Wildlife Service. What that cooperation looks like will remain to be seen, but it's definitely a better situation than we had under the previous administration.
All of this is happening in a context where people are using land for agriculture. Are there ways that wolves and cattle can live in happy harmony?
Yes, there are. Making that paradigm work with the grazing systems we have in the Southwest, it's one of the more difficult situations, because it's a grazing pattern that was allowed to evolve through the persecution of predators. They can generally let the cattle loose on huge expanses of rangeland, let's say 300 cattle on 80,000 acres of grazing permits. And, you know, managing and keeping eyes on that many cattle is very difficult. Some of the more proven methods, like guard animals, guard dogs or guard donkeys even,
guard donkeys?
Oh, yeah. And guard llamas are very effective in confined situations. But you can't, you know, you can't afford to put a guard dog on every cow. So there's a group that's been formed, that the agency formed, that's sort of rancher-driven with some input from particularly the Defenders of Wildlife, which has been involved for a long time in trying to come up with coexistence models for coexisting with large carnivores, especially in agriculture. And there's a handful of ranchers that have agreed to join that group and look at various methods of coexisting with wolves. But it involves three levels of program. Using non-lethal methods is one.
Like what?
Like bringing your herd into a confined area to have its calves, instead of letting them have calves at random on the open range. So the prevailing paradigm is there's a whole bigger herd of cows out there, some bulls with them. They breed whenever they choose to. They drop their calves, you know, not at the same time, and scattered all over the rangeland. Bring them into a confined area, time the breeding, time the calving, let the calves get a few weeks on them before they go out back out with their mother cows on the range. That's one example. Range riders have been shown to be quite effective. Just having a cowboy on the range, riding out and keeping track of the herd. One of the things they do through this, what they call coexistence council, is if a pack of wolves choose to den on a certain grazing allotment, which is one of these, you know, areas of 5 to 10,000 acres or more, and another grazing allotment is not currently being used, ranchers will agree often to move their cattle to an allotment that's further away from the wolves. Agency also uses techniques like supplemental feeding. They'll take roadkill deer and elk, drop them near a den site to try to keep the wolves well fed so they're not, you know, enticed to go chase cattle.
Well, that's one of the things I was going to ask you about was if you support elk populations, does that prevent, I mean, do wolves prefer to eat elk?
They do. That's the predominant diet of our wolves, is mostly elk and some deer. But yeah, if we had more elk, it would be a different situation. You know, the elk populations are kept where they are for two reasons. One is through, you know, well, through the issuance of hunting licenses. And the other is the Forest Service actually allocates the forage. So elk and cattle pretty much eat the same thing on the range. A grazing allotment is actually set up to allocate, let's say, half that for cattle, half that for elk. Used to be a lot higher. I guess I've been told that those allocations have become more equitable between cattle and elk.
Who used to have more?
In other words, it used to be 80% for the cattle, 20% for the elk. And so, you know, they're in competition for the food. You know, an extreme example, if you just take the cattle off, then the elk would have access to all the forage. There would be more elk. There would be less conflict between wolves and cattle because the cattle wouldn't be there, for one thing.
So you're saying if cattle were removed from public land, which is what a lot of environmentalists
are fighting for. Groups that advocate for that, yes.
Yeah.
The fact that we have and we sanction and we allow grazing on public land of domestic livestock is pretty much the sole source of all of the problems and conflict that we have to deal with. You know, they didn't have it in Yellowstone National Park. That went beautifully. Once they crossed outside the borders, it didn't. It looks like everywhere else, you know, you get the conflict immediately and the politics that respond to that.
So here we are almost at the end of 2019, and we're looking at a situation that is well over a century in the making. You have wolves, they're driven nearly to extinction, they're brought back, and now there's a lot of conflict because it's not the same land as it was 100, 150 years ago. What would you like to leave our listeners with? And if they support the idea of wolf introduction, what would you like them to know and what can they do to help?
Well, now's a very good time for us to be talking about that because often there's not an action that you can change. But right now we have this really excellent opportunity where all the rules that apply to managing that wild population have to be revisited. And they have to be revisited in a way that complies with an order of the federal court.
Because of that ruling you were talking about.
Because of the ruling. And so things have to change. And the more advocates that add their voice to that, the more change we're likely to get that's good for the wolves. And so watch for that. One good place to go is the go-to place for what action you can take right now or in the future is the simply MexicanWolves.org.
MexicanWolves.org.
Or Lobos of the Southwest. That's the name of that site is. And that's the, you know, that's the action center. That's the face of groups combining their ideas on what the best strategy is. And so you can get tips there on what you can do now. Once this process is opened up, you know, there'll be an opportunity for your voice to be even more effective because it becomes official part of the record of submitting comments on changes to this regulation. So that's our best shot coming up right now. But, you know, the most conservationists operate under the constant pressure constantly applied. Never give up, letters to the editor, op-eds, anything to keep the issue in the public eye.
You've spent so many years on this issue. What are your hopes for the southwestern United States, wolves, cattle, ecosystems, and people?
Wow. That we all get along. That we all find a way to meet our needs cooperatively without, you know, having to deal with all this conflict with seemingly intractability of all those goals coming together on the same piece of land, so to speak, the same landscape, there are models. We know it can happen. Patterns have to change. Thinking has to change. Ways of doing animal husbandry have to change. It's not like it was 100 years ago. It's a new world.
It's a new world that is much more fragile than we thought it was.
Exactly.
David Parsons is carnivore conservation biologist with the Rewilding Institute, which we did. There's so much more to talk about. We didn't talk about everything. But ladies and gentlemen, you can go to rewilding.org, and you can also go to mexicanwolves.org. Dave Parsons, thanks for spending this time with us.
You're welcome.
And that's our show for today. The Radio Cafe would like to thank its sponsors, the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, the Lenzic Performing Arts Center, the Southwest Care Center, the Lannan Foundation, and the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks to all of you for making the show possible. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.